The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins is brought to you by our most secure sponsor, SimpliSafe. If you don't have a high-quality home security system, or if you've got a low-quality home security system, get SimpliSafe. I use it at home, and it is awesome. Listen in for SimpliSafe's spot later in the show, and please support SimpliSafe, because SimpliSafe supports us. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. I should also warn you that the language in this week's addendum is a bit strong. Just want to give you a heads up. Enjoy the program.
D. Watkins here with Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today I'll be joined by Rabia, Marsha, Amelia, and Justine. We reached the end of our season. We covered so many things and just shed light on so many different topics that people just aren't aware of. And then you flick on the news and you see the dash cam video from what happened with Philando Castile and his girlfriend Diamond Reynolds. And you know, he was executed in front of his daughter while he was wearing a seatbelt, telling the police officer that he has a firearm, that he has a license. Of course, the NRA is silent because it was a black man. But the NRA, they don't want to be called racist. So you say something bad about them, you have like the black Uncle Ruckus Samuel L. Jackson from the Django types saying, "Oh, the NRA loves us all." Well, you know, all of you people are quiet, meaning you subscribe to the same thing. So we know these things. We have this information. Hundreds of thousands of people listen to this podcast, but yet we still have these situations.
I mean, I don't understand. I figured, having read a lot about the Philando Castile case and having seen, obviously, Diamond Reynolds' video, like, I was already sort of like, how did this verdict happen? But then seeing the dash cam video, I mean, I don't understand how that, I don't know what the jury was confused about. Like, what?
Yeah, and what you were saying about the NRA, you know, I've been exploring this a bit because it kind of came up when I was looking into the knife. And what's interesting is that the knife rights organizations, the people that want these switchblades and non-switchblades to be legal and not prosecuted, they are race conscious. They are aware that African Americans are disproportionately arrested. But when it comes to the gun rights organizations do not care at all. We had a public defender that was working with us who told me a story about African American middle-aged man arrested for possession of a completely legal gun. And he couldn't get any of the local gun rights or lobbyists or organizations to write a letter on his behalf saying, or the manufacturers to say, like, yes, this is a legal gun. And they were like, well, we sort of just like to help police. It's like, well, isn't the point that you have
arms? But when you call them racist, they get upset. They get offended.
It's worse to be called.
They deny it.
It's worse to be called racist than to be racist.
They tell you about their black.
Apparently.
They'll tell you about their black friend, Jamal. You know, like, you know, so I feel like, you know, the investigative side and the work you guys put in and how we all collectively talked about this information and talked to some great guests and opened the floor up to have conversations that a lot of people are scared to have. You know, one thing I want to key on is the big takeaway for you guys and what you discovered. And then hopefully we can try to figure out ways to use your responses to move forward, because that's, you know, that's why we do the work that we do. We want people to be aware so that they can be more conscious and that so that the world can be better.
I mean, I will say that, you know, one of the things I've found so interesting about this case, and, you know, I've largely focused on some of the sort of documented evidence. You know, I've spent a lot of time looking at CCTV footage. I spent a lot of time reading, you know, computer automated dispatch reports. And these are all things, both of these things are technically in the public space. Like, these are things that the public can request to see. And what's been staggering for me is that on both of these things, on both the reports for the police radio and on the CCTV footage, there are glaring issues. There are things that illustrate that something's not right about the story that we were told about what happened to Freddie Gray. And those were things that especially the CAD reports that show what really happened on the police radio, were all things that could have been requested at the time. And I mean, they show so many issues with the case that BPD sort of sold the public on, and that the prosecutors, the state's attorney's office, brought to trial. And, you know, I think one of the biggest things I've learned, and one of the things that I would want to sort of impart to other people, whether it's the media or loved ones of people who are in these situations, is request that stuff as soon as possible. Start digging and looking right away. Because A, I think if anything, we've shown anything in this case, it's that the police will cover stuff up, but they aren't always very good at it, and they can be sloppy. And, you know, don't rely on the police to do the investigation, unfortunately. Like, some of this stuff is available, request it. And I think that that's a big deal. Like, I don't know. That's one of the things I took away from it. I'm already like, I look at all these new cases in the news and I'm like, I want the reports for this. I want to see what was really happening on dispatch in the Charlena Lyles case, for example, in Seattle, because I think that there are probably some interesting little bits that could help her family, for example.
And, you know, it's like, can we just say that it's okay? I mean, can we be one of the first diverse groups of people to collectively agree on this being okay from society standpoint? Because if I'm watching this as a child, and I see, oh, wow, you know, this Trayvon, even though Zimmerman wasn't a cop, he was a play cop, but he still killed the black person, and he had gun people, and he had supporters, and he had, you know, GoFundMes that went viral and all of these different things, because society is saying, yeah, the young man didn't do anything. Yeah, he had a hoodie on. Yeah, he was, you know, he was black and in a hoodie, and that's illegal. If you look at what happened with Eric Garner, you know, he was choked on tape by a chokehold that was outlawed, you know. We know what happened with Freddie Gray. We've been talking about it. We've spent hours and hours talking about this. You know, we see what just happened with, you know, Castell and some of these other situations. You know, even going all the way back to, like, what happened with Jonathan Furrow in North Carolina. You know, police officer, you know, he gets convicted, but he comes right out on appeal. You know, it's like society is sending a message to America, not just black America, but to America, that's white America, Asian America, Mexican, everybody, that killing black people is okay. And we're going to support you in that, especially if you're wearing a badge, especially if you're wearing a badge, 100%.
One of the big takeaways for me, I made it like a mission to try to crack the puzzle of policing, how it works and how, say, good cops are somehow still not behaving in ways that are conducive for us and society. And so I've had like a lot of conversations, and I've engaged in a lot of interesting Twitter feeds, and I've read a lot of probable cause statements and looked at arresting habits. And, you know, I think the larger cultural changes can only happen within police leadership, and it needs to matter to them. You know, I was part of this really intense like Twitter exchange that was kind of, I mean, you know, almost a year of doing this, and it really changed my thinking. There's a group of police officers and other former prosecutors in Baltimore that, you know, had high leadership positions and have left the force and are now chatting on Twitter about how upset they are about the crime rate in Baltimore and the changes that they want to make. And I've talked with a lot of them individually and as a group. And for the most part, even though they can be combative and aggressive in their conversations with me, they engage. And I've earned respect from asking really pointed questions. And the question I asked this a couple of days ago was like, you know, I've had a conversation with a cop and he just had a lot of bias. Is there anything that can be done in the academy to discuss bias, you know, racial bias or socioeconomic bias? And I received so much venom. I was harassed and I was blocked and it was crazy. I had crossed this line that, and I was accused of race baiting and I was told there is no bias. And, you know, this was white and African-American cops were sort of like, and I was trying to give them statistics to show, like, you know, disproportionate arrests for possession in low-income African-American. They just were not having any of it. And I came to this realization that for them, just to put myself in their mindset, for them to hear that is like, if you're like an ardent feminist being told that all women are something. They thought I was calling them racists when I was trying to say, hey, look, all these other professions address bias issues. They, all of them, you can't be a doctor unless you have significant training in cultural bias. So why? They feel this huge prejudice around this. They want you to know that they are not racist and they don't understand that the system is. They can only see crime. And that was part of something else that I've learned, which has to do with reading probable cause statements and seeing how police officers are able to justify all of their arrests unchecked, especially in Baltimore. Just by saying, like, for instance, with the Dante Allen arrests or so-called arrests, you know, it looked like he had a bulge in his pocket. And based on what we know about the community, we felt like we could detain him. And then it was like an issue of a loose cigarette and that maybe he had some drugs in his possession. But that thing of like, I work in this community, my training and experience tells me that I can arrest this person because I think they might have a bulge in their pocket. He didn't have a gun-sized bulge in his pocket. So there's this sense with them, it's this dual sense of like infallibility, I can do what I want, and if anyone attacks me, I'm a victim.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Dennis, and I want you to imagine something for me. Let's say you're at home, lying down on your bed, listening to this podcast. It's nighttime, you've put the kids to sleep. Suddenly, you hear something break downstairs. You go to investigate, but you don't see anything. You can't figure out what it is. Nothing fell, you check the windows, none of them are broken. What do you do in that situation? Well, you could turn on all the lights and keep watch. You could check your kid's bed every hour. You could sleep with one eye open. Or you can rest easy knowing that your home and family are protected with SimpliSafe. When you install your SimpliSafe home security system, you're arming your home with powerful sensors that actually tell you if a door opens or if a window breaks. There's a 105 decibel siren that alerts you at the first sign of trouble. You'll have a dedicated team of security professionals watching over you 24/7, ready to send the police. Not only that, but with SimpliSafe, there are no long-term contracts. You get around-the-clock monitoring at only $14.99 a month. So don't spend another night second-guessing your home safety. Get SimpliSafe and get some rest. Go to SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com and get a special 10% discount when you order today. That's SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com for 10% off your order. SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com.
This is why I get so upset when people come at me like, hey, D, all cops aren't bad. Hey, D, there are some good ones. Because it's like you're having a clean conversation where you're presenting facts.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I haven't known you my whole life, but for the short amount of time I've known you, everything that you ever said has been based on something that you've researched. I don't think you just talk. Like, you know, I think you know what you're talking about when you say things. And I say that because, you know, where are the good cops at in Minnesota that are like jumping up saying, wait a second, this dash cam was wrong. That's not good police. We don't operate like that. We know the officer was fired. We know he's a coward. We know that he subscribes to that same dehumanization of black people that allows you to kill a person after a 40-second interaction. But where are the police officers locking arms and standing up and saying, you know what? This is not a representation of what we believe in. Where the fuck are they at?
They're there and they will not say it in public. And like, for instance,
so
on
they're
that,
part of the problem. They're part of the problem.
Yes.
They're not good. They're just as scared as the guy Yanez, whatever his name is, yeah. Was Geronimo Yanez. They're cowards just like him, because when it's time for you to jump up there and say, but blue lives matter and police is this and police is that, you got all the rap in the world. But when it's time for you to talk about some shit that matters, you murdering a man in front of his daughter, a citizen that paid taxes, a citizen, a person that was loved and appreciated, and you can't say nothing, then I can't call you good. I can't do it.
They're all quiet on this, you know, but I know from my private conversations with them how they actually feel. And I mean, I would love some of them.
No, but see, that doesn't count.
I'm not saying that excuses it, but I think it's important to understand that these issues are so deeply systemic. If you have people that I find to be intelligent and brave, and the only ones that are ever willing to speak up at all all are the ones that are very long retired and held powerful positions, don't have family members in the force, and are finally able to say something. But I think it's important not to excuse anybody for anything, but to understand that system where it is so scary for them to speak up, where they don't want to lose all of their friends. They don't want to lose the only society. I hate to say it, but it's cultish to me. Yeah. It operates like a cult. And that's like Scientology, you know, and what it took for the Scientologists to come forward and speak out. And believe me, any cop who hears this is going to be pissed at me and will probably block me again. But, you know, that is the level of fear. We would say, how could these Scientologists go along with this?
I won't block you. That's all that matters. I'm saying this. Like, let's say if I was your neighbor, right? And I'm walking. You know what I do for a living. You know I teach and you know I write in these things. And I'm walking through my alley and you see some cops, like, stop me and grab me. So it's like, are you going to say, hey, he lives in this neighborhood. You know, don't talk to him like that. He lives here. Or don't try to grab him. He's a resident here. Or are you going to just look? You know, like, this happened to me. My neighbors looked. They looked and they went in the house.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and then as soon as it was, you know, yeah. And as soon as it was time, you know, as soon as they caught me walking to my car, hey, what happened with that? Are you okay? Motherfucker, you know, I live around here. You ain't say nothing. You saw this man with that he, one of them had is he had his, you know, you see this dude talking to me all crazy, asking me, what am I doing in my garage? Motherfucker, it's mine. This is mine. Like, this is my garage, just like my taxes paid for you and your dumb ass gun. So it's like, I would say because it's right. Like, it's being part of a cult and all of that shit. Like, that's bullshit. Like, if you don't say something, you're just a bad person. What happened to the woman? Was she in Milwaukee? Remember the woman that made the video?
Yeah.
Remember she made a video. She was a cop.
Oh,
and she
right.
was saying
yeah.
that, her video went viral. It's like, she's a woman. And, you know, she's a cop and she loves her job. And she feels like her police officers, you know, I wasn't performing the way they were supposed to perform. She was brave. Like, I don't know what happened to her, but she was a brave person. She was a great person.
Dee, it's your job. It is your job, you know, as somebody who's dealt with this, you know, as a part of your daily life, to address it with judgment and call things bad and good. I see my role differently because I want to keep engaging and try to understand it. And I'm not saying it's not, I think the system is bad. And, you know, some of the individuals are very bad. And I think the system brings out the worst in them. I think that the kind of cultural chin learns, first do no harm. With great power comes great responsibility. Cops learn, protect your own. Don't get hurt out there, hurt other people before. So that is like a major change that needs to happen, where cops realize that when they walk into communities, they're not victims going to war. They are the guardians of the community. They are the most powerful people there. They aren't taught to think that way. And I like, those are the changes that I want to see happen. There's already us versus them. So I don't want to, you know, call people bad necessarily, but that also needs to be said, you know?
Yeah, you can't play the 50 though. Like, even like, you're doing what's right or you're not. Whispering to you is not gonna like make, you know, these problems away. It's just not.
The one thing I would say is I really think, you know, we're told all the time how brave police officers are and how, you know, how much risk they take and how they put themselves on the line. And that's always thrown kind of in the faces of anybody who criticizes the police, whether it's a specific officer for shooting an unarmed civilian or if it's talking about policing in general. And for me, it's when something like, you look at the Philando Castile dash cam video and then you see there's crickets when it comes from these supposedly kind of good cops. For me, I think, what does bravery mean to you? Because it bothers me a lot that I feel like, why are we giving people a gun and telling them to go out and police a community when they're not brave enough to sort of speak out against murder? I'll call what that was. That was murder. But I also
get
where Justine's...
Like, yeah. That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah,
come
I don't
on.
Get it. Like, I get from Justine's point of view, I think it's important for somebody... it's very important on this particular podcast for somebody to have been able to put aside, but just like focus on trying to understand that particular point of view. And Justine and I have talked about this. I couldn't have done it for various reasons. It's not my personality to be able to hold my tongue. And she, I don't know why it worked out that way, but Justine was really, was good at this. But we've also talked, you know, plenty privately, and we also know, I also know how she feels about this stuff personally. And I think it was important for this project in order to have really sort of as much balance as possible, especially since we couldn't get any police to talk to us on the record.
I mean, but not even on, like, not even on the show. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, things don't change because we allow this type of mentality to exist. Like, we allow it. This is a country that, you know, I mean, how many whistleblowers have been prosecuted? Like, anyway, things don't change because we allow people to get away when not doing what they're supposed to do. Police officers don't do what they're supposed to do. People, concerned citizens, or people who say they love people, or say they're noble, or say they're heroes, or say they're here to protect, they only protect themselves because they're scared to talk. And this is why we will always continue to run our heads against the wall when discussing these issues, because these people, you know, it's something wrong with them. It's something wrong with them. I can't watch you murder somebody, and I know I'm getting paid to protect, but I can't murder somebody and I know I'm getting paid to look out for that person.
Well, I think the other sort of the other big takeaway for me in looking at how police investigate themselves and to try to understand why we're not getting anywhere with these cases, even though they're so public, and it's probably a huge majority of the public looks at that and says, you know, that officer with Castile, you know, something should happen to him. He should pay some kind of penalty. I think the reason we don't get anywhere is that there are no systems in place to really, really address the criminal aspect of police misconduct. They're kind of new. The police are so put off at the prospect that they could be breaking the law on their jobs. They cannot wrap their head around that. They think, look, we make mistakes on the job, or this cop needed better training. And they're willing to admit that some cops are like jerks and do break the law if they're stealing. But when, that's the thing, Seth Stoughton talked to me about this. When cops are stealing, or when, you know, when they're hiding evidence, the other cops will go after them. When they use excessive force, they quiet down. Why? Because force is a part of their jobs. I mean, obviously, if they need to restrain like an actual murderer or an actual terrible person, they may need to use force, and they do need to. And so they can't wrap their head around, this is very new for them. And it's, look, again, not justifying it, just to understand it. They feel traumatized by this, and they feel it adds fuel to the us versus them sort of framework of it. What needs to happen is that I really do believe we need outside agencies that are responsible for investigating and prosecuting cops if they behave criminally, especially with relationship to force, because then they'll be scared and they'll understand it better. If they think it's coming from the inside, they know they're probably going to be protected as long as their intentions are good and they do all their paperwork, you know? So that's sort of been a big takeaway for me. We would need progressive leadership in our country, and it would need to be, I think, systematized, you know, or at least force by force, like one agency after the other would have to do this and model it. And I don't understand why the forces don't do this, because it takes it out of their hands. Like if Commissioner Batts Davis were to say, look, this is what happened, we're handing it over to them, then they're not responsible. Politically, they're safe. So I don't know why more agencies don't do this. Right now, politically, what happened? Anthony Batts lost his job. Mosby's gonna have a lot of trouble getting reelected. The mayor's gone. They should have just handed it over. You know, not that necessarily the outside agencies, but there should be trained outside agencies. You know, that's one big step.
Something needs to be also just done about the law, though, because Philando Castile is a perfect example. Like, from what I can tell, the prosecution laid out a pretty strong case. I mean, I still need to sort of look closer at it. But if the jury saw that entire dash cam video and they still come back with a not guilty on manslaughter, by the way, like low charges.
Right.
Because based solely, I think from what I can tell, solely on the fact that Yanez is able to argue that he felt feared for his life. And there are laws in place that at a high level, I believe, isn't it like the Supreme Court has ruled on these types of things that basically allow for cops to, once they say that, then it seems that the jury is sort of given instructions that they really actually sort of have to weigh that. To me, you look at that Philando Castile verdict and it doesn't matter how good your case is. It doesn't matter how much, how flawless the evidence is, how clear it is. If the jury is led to believe that the cops fear for their life. Simply saying that, and if they believe it, that's enough to acquit. It doesn't matter how good the case is. It doesn't matter how good the investigation is.
I just wrote that this morning as like, this is a coward cop get out of jail free card. All you got to do is say I'm scared. Doesn't even matter. It even worked. Look at Tamir Rice,
a
little boy, like a little boy. And all he said was, I'm just scared. So that's why I say we got to really, really be careful on how we throw around this word brave and hero and good. We got to be careful because you can't play hero. Even you going to jump in front of that car or that bullet to save that person, or you not. You can't make a mistake. You know, you can't fake try to save a person. Even you saving them or you not. You can't fake being like a person that cares and being compassionate, even you doing it, or you just not. You just not. Like talking to you and talking to me, somebody coming to me, people really, really think that because they know me, it mean they connected to the streets. No, that don't mean you connected to no streets. That don't mean you making, talking to me is not making a difference. Like having a conversation with me at a restaurant where the plates cost $50, you know you're not making a difference. You just talking to a person that happens to live in these different worlds. You're not helping the next Freddie Gray not become the next Freddie Gray. So that shit, it don't mean nothing.
You know, I have like two thoughts. One of them is when you said that get out of jail free, you know, I was scared. I think at this point, Amelia and I could produce a few pages of those kinds of tropes. One of them would be like, based on my training and experience, like I talked about, you know, well, look, I might have arrested him wrongfully, but you know, I was relying on my training and experience. That's one. Also just like the car smelled like marijuana, which we saw with Castile. This is very common in Baltimore policing too.
Oh my God, he saved the little girl's life by saving her from the smell of marijuana.
I mean, can I just say like that?
He saved her life by killing her father.
That whole thing, I'm just like, are you serious?
But that's common. They all say that all the time.
The other thing I was going to say is, you know, and this is related to the fact that, you know, even if you had a perfect case, it wouldn't necessarily lead to a conviction because of this whole sort of I was fearing for my life. And there is also just, it's like you said, Dave, it's like they know that they can. I look through at the evidence in the case files and I see so much sloppiness. At the same time, I also see a lot of cover your ass work, and the combination, the covering of the ass, but also the sloppiness about it.
Yeah.
It contributes to me. I look at that and I'm like, oh God, you guys thought you were just going to be fine. you just thought, like, I feel like in this, our last episode, as I went over the sort of dispatch reports and showed that frankly, at stop two, they were creating options for themselves. They were squatting on two different CAD records at around the same time period, not associating them together. That's essentially creating options for themselves. I hope that came through in the episode, that people understood that. That as of stop two, those officers were creating two options for themselves for one detainee. What does that tell you? That Freddie was injured at stop two and they went into cover-up mode instantly. But looking through the records, it's so sloppy. It's like they knew, okay, we have to clean up after ourselves. Meanwhile, they have this dying prisoner on their hands. And then also just sort of, but not so stressed out about it that they're doing a perfect job, you know? Like, what the fuck? I mean, and then nobody did anything. You look at these records and the state's attorney's office, there are glaring, obvious problems with the fucking timeline just based on these reports. And nobody, they didn't care. I'm sick over it. I'm sick.
And I think we have to look at Rice, because this is the lieutenant, you know, looking at what he was doing that day. Who's going to have the knowledge? You know, he was over 15, almost 20 years on the force, about dispatch reports and about sort of where to hide from the CCTV and all of that. Like, who's going to have that level of knowledge about, in terms of going into cover-up mode? You know, around stop two, it would seem like that's kind of when they pulled together this whole other van rioter story and arranged that too. I think the state's attorney knows that. I think they know that they sat on a conspiracy charge that would have been, in my opinion, much more effective, you know, the whole cover-up of it.
Even if they'd lost on that, I said this early at the season, the truth matters. Even if the truth won't win in court, I don't give a fuck. Clearly, having the best case in the world won't get you a conviction either. So you know what? Go in there with the truth at the very least so people know.
And that's with the dropping of the knife charge, mm-hmm. too. I mean, they will say till they're blue in the face that they decided not to bring up the knife in court and its legality because they had a better theory that Freddie Gray was, there was an assault because he was sort of detained and touched too long before they found the knife. And it's like, you still had an arrest for no reason. That knife was legal.
Why not do both?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Both. Hello.
Even if it's losing.
It's like strategically smart. Come on.
I mean, the whole case was losing. They weren't going to be able to prosecute people for serious crimes based on the fact that they didn't seatbelt, based on a policy that was days old, if that. So they, as long as they were going that route to expose the department, they should have really exposed them, you know?
Seriously, go balls to the wall, man.
The standards are so low. And again, these killings are backed, you know, they're backed by the state, they're backed by this country. The country's okay with it. Those of us who aren't, you know, evil and cold, we care. But the country as a whole, it doesn't care. You know, it's crazy. I'm in places where, like, I hear white people and I hear black people and I hear, you know, progressive black people who don't really normally have a lot of proximity to these types of situations. And they all get together and they argue over Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter. And it's like, you care more about that shit than you actually care about real black lives. Because if you really, really care about real black lives, I don't give a fuck about what anybody says. I care about people. Hashtag whatever the fuck you want. I care about people. I don't care about no fucking technicalities. Get the fuck out of here with a technicality. Come on. Like, who care? Like, how does it translate? Okay, you hashtag Black Lives Matter, so that means that you helping a black person out of a tough situation. You hashtag All Lives Matter, that means you helping some racially ambiguous guy. Like, what? Like, who are you? Who are you really helping? It don't matter what your phone, what's on your phone. It doesn't matter.
I think that people really have to follow these cases through in general, too. I know this is hard, especially, and it's especially hard when they seem to be happening every week. So, I mean, this is awful. When it's hard to keep track of the black citizens who are being killed by police, I'm sorry, that's a crisis. And the thing is that we get, you know, everybody gets so upset initially when these things happen. And it's maybe for a couple weeks or something like that. And then another one happens. And the one that just happened sort of starts to fade from memory. And there's often a very sort of long period of time in between the incident itself and maybe when the officer gets charged or not charged, or if they go to trial, which is rare. And in that time, you know, so much happens that people aren't kind of following along. And I know that it takes time and it's emotionally taxing to follow these cases, but it's important to, because the minute our eyes are taken off of them, that's when I think the sort of shady cover-up business really starts to happen, because they think people aren't watching. And that's why, you know, I've wanted this podcast to get so much more attention, not because, you know, I don't care about getting attention. I care about this evidence getting attention, because this is stuff that did not come out. That needs to be out there. It's important. It may not have any effect on this case at all. Freddie is dead. Those officers, most of them can't be recharged. And the ones that could be recharged won't be, unless Mosby, well, it won't happen. But it still matters, because the truth matters. And also in this case, you can see things that will be reflected in other cases in the future. And the more we know, the more we can do to sort of call that shit out while it's happening.
Yeah, I wonder if what it's, I mean, I guess I don't wonder. I assume that what it's going to take is, you know, maybe this would happen under Trump, is for a lot of white people to be killed by the state. And then it would be like, wow, that's my relative. I mean, this is one of the things I think with cops, is that the ones that are the so-called good cops, who believe themselves to be good cops that other cops regard as good and ethical, are very interested in fighting crime. That is their mission. They understand that there might be casualties along the way, or people might get detained or arrested that shouldn't have been arrested or detained. And they don't understand what a big deal it is. It would have to happen to them for them to understand that, like, casually arresting someone, hey, we let them go, don't worry about it, we got something else. It's a big deal. So for cops, it would have to happen to them. And then for the community to be outraged enough, it would have to, I think it would have to be, that, you know, the majority of this country is still white. It would have to be people that look like their brothers and sisters and cousins getting shot by the state. And then there would be enough outrage. I am trying to think of a parallel.
But that's really not going to happen because that's illegal. You can't just go around shooting white people. I was telling this white guy, not the other day, but it was a while back, but he was talking about walking through a certain neighborhood in East Baltimore and being scared. And I was like, dog, you're the safest person. Mm-hmm. They don't know if you're a cop. They don't know if you, you know, if you own, like, you know, one of these major organizations or something, a doctor. They don't know what you are. They just know you. Cause this is a guy that I know. So, you know, I'm like, yo, they just know you're a funny looking white dude. You could be anything. Fucking George Bush's nephew. They don't know that. So you good, bro. Like, you good. Like, nothing's going to happen to you. If the police pull over, you know, they might ask you, is you okay? And if you look a little strange or suspicious, they're going to instantly assume that you're buying drugs and you still probably get a pass. You still get a pass. Well, you know, it'd be tough times for white guys these days. Guy needs his drugs. Hey, let him get his drugs. Hey, throw in a couple of free ones for him. You know, you need to ride back to your side of town and escort, you know, like, it's crazy.
It's
like,
different for women because we don't feel safe anywhere, you know? And I will say
that in Baltimore, the times that I've been down there, I had the creepiest experience downtown when that weird white dude followed me after I went to the gun store. That was where I felt the least safe. And then every single time I've gone to Sandtown, I've not even for a second felt unsafe. Because there's no reason to screw with me. It's fine.
Like, well, yeah. I mean, and also, yeah. And also, like, what happens to black men who screw with white women? You know, it's right. Like a serious lynching time. But I think that, like, what I was going to say is that I think there's like an opportunity here for more understanding, like tapping into the fear of being a woman. You know, I mean, I guess pretty much anywhere late at night, I'm going to be, you know, somewhat afraid, mm-hmm. Unless I'm with a large group of people and there's a lot of people on the street. That's just how I'm going to feel. And I feel like we should be able to understand better and talk about it better from that level. You know, gay people, trans people, there's fear a lot just for being out in the world. And we should be able to understand better how it is to be African-American, being afraid that you're going to be profiled or killed, you know?
Empathy. Mm-hmm. It's a heck of a thing, you know?
Yeah.
Or just believe people. When people tell you about their lives and talking to so many witnesses down in Sandtown and just learning not just about what happened with Freddie, but just what sort of daily life is there, and talking to you, Dee, about your experiences both growing up in East Baltimore and living there now. And just, I mean, I haven't had any of those experiences, but I trust that they happen to you and they happen to the people I've talked to, and that matters. It doesn't matter whether I can relate. It matters that I am open to the fact that other people have different experiences in life. Why is this so hard for people? Empathize. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's an important thing to do.
Yeah, it's funny how they get mad at, like, you know, Black Lives Matters they're saying, you know, you guys think that you're victims. It's like, nobody thinks that they're victims more than cops. You know, mm-hmm. Which is, I guess, what we're talking about.
That's so crazy. Oh, my God.
Babies. God.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Sorry, Justine.
No, that's it. You know, it's just.
I'm sorry.
It's hilarious.
It's a huge victim culture. Yeah. You know, they feel that they're allowed to think that they're under attack. They do not wrap their head around the power of owning a gun. When I watch, like, police shows that take place in England, what is Happy Valley? I don't know if you guys have ever seen that.
They don't even carry weapons.
They don't. It's like this 50-year-old blonde woman running around with a club being a badass, you know? It's so refreshing. And it's like all of those people that she kind of detains and arrests would all be dead in our country, you know?
Right. Well, you know, one of the most powerful things about America is the way fear is marketed and promoted. And that fear that exists here is one of the primary reasons for our gun culture. Everybody's scared.
Yeah.
Everybody's scared. These people are scared. Like, you see something like what happened at Sandy Hook. Uh-huh. And then the first response you get from the gun lovers is, you're not going to take my guns. You know, the teachers and hall monitors and, you know, crossing guards should all have guns. And it's like, yo, like, it's never no guns. It's always more guns, more fear, more guns, more fear. That cop who killed Castell was terrified. He was scared. And that's not him. That's, you know, he falls into the tradition of Leo Africanus, of Richard Baxter, of Cotton Mather, of Thomas Jefferson. Like, he's part of that tradition. That's American tradition. The strange, scary, beastly Negro. Mm-hmm. That's an American thing, like apple pie, what? Like yeah. The Star Spangled Banner, like fucking baseball.
No, you're
that's
right.
What he fell victim to. That's what's on his back as he aimed that gun and pulled that trigger.
And that fear is reflected in so many things, like in pop culture. I mean, I hate to use this as an example, but it's the first one to pops into mind. This week on The Bachelorette, there's a black bachelorette this season, and one of her suitors is a black man, and there's some white guys too. And one of the white guys is repeatedly calling kind of one of the black men angry and scary, and we don't even think about it. I mean, I think that guy is aware of what he's doing. But the way in which we project sort of an animalistic or scary presentation onto black men, particularly in pop culture, in all sorts of ways that we're not even necessarily conscious of or that we don't automatically recognize. And I think we need to be a lot more conscious of that because it normalizes it. It normalizes seeing every black man as somehow being scary.
You know, and that's an American thing. So when are we going to admit that it's okay to murder black people? When are we going to admit that black lives don't matter to most of the people in this country? When are we going to admit that black lives definitely don't matter to this government, unless we're talking about prison labor, you know, or slavery and how great it's been for this country, or sports? But other than that, like, these are hard truths. That, and so that's why, like, it might seem like I might go hard on the government, or I might be really, 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 like, judgmental of law enforcement. But I know that in the life and death situations I've been in, when it's time for me to perform, if it's time for me to help a person or save a person or be there for a person, I can't do that shit halfway and still call myself a stand-up guy or a hero. It doesn't work. If I'm a doctor, you know, because we talk about other professions a lot. If I'm a doctor and I know that I got to do something to a certain part of somebody's body to save them, I can't halfway do it. I can't whisper to my colleagues about how great I would have been. You know, I got to do it, or I can't walk around with my chest out. I can't look in the mirror. I can't get credit for being something that I'm not. Like, I just can't. I just, you know, and this is the reason why stuff doesn't change.
I mean, I haven't read this study, but I would guess that, like, entitlement breeds less empathy, and that people who have been through things as you have or have been oppressed are more empathetic and therefore more willing to do things. I mean, I don't know if this is important for the podcast, but just as part of the conversation, you know, I've been dealing with chronic illness and disability, and the people who are there for me the most are similarly struggling with similar issues. Unfortunately, we can't help each other. Like, we need help from healthy bodied people, you know, and we can't help each other because we're dealing with stuff every day. And that is sort of the problem. It's like, I remember I used to teach GED, and it was in Harlem. And I just remember my students, not all of them, you know, some of them were assholes, but, you know, a few of them being like, if they were selfish assholes and definitely using the system. But if I, you know, students saying things like, if I have $2, I'm going to give somebody one. And it was like, these were people that were depending on public assistance who were the most generous people I've ever met. And that's kind of how it works, is like, we're trying to seek help, and the only people that are going to respond are people that really need a lot of help themselves, you know?
For sure. Like, it is what it is. So it's like, I can't, you know, I can't sit back and I can't acknowledge good that's whispered, because it doesn't mean anything to me. Like, it doesn't mean anything to me. It's like, it doesn't really translate. It's like you telling me you needed some money to get out of a certain situation, and then the situation happened and now you're buried, and I just pop up and be like, I whisper to Amelia, like, yo, you know, I would have gave Justine that money. Like, you don't fucking need it no more. Like, they already came and took the car away. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It's like, you know, and then now I'm a hero. You know, I was there for her, whispering when she needed me. I was telling Amelia how much I would have stepped in. And, you know, it's kind of like when you grow up and it's like the, you know, we used to call them like the Wooda guys. Like, you know, you get in the fight. So, you know, we back in the neighborhood with busted lips and chipped teeth and all that. And you know, and it's the dude who comes out there. Yo, if I was there, I would have did this. I would have did that. I would have knocked everybody. I would have been knocking people out. Yo, you would have did everything, but then as soon as the situation happened, you end up being the first person that took off and left us to get stomped out and all that. So it's like, you know,
that's amazing.
Yeah, you know, it was in a just like a Jada Kiss line. You know, what a kid. I always talk about what he would have did. know, and it's like, it's step up and stand out or just go away. I want you to touch on the investigative part, the part that you wanted to talk about, Justine.
Yeah, that is a really good question. I think that this work is document and evidence management, I think, is a big issue that I feel like we touched upon, and I don't hear it discussed in these issues with the policing, which is how these documents, how these videos are managed, how the audio is managed, and how the files are managed, the evidence itself is managed. I would hope that we can kind of get the word out more, and that going forward, when there's a case of police misconduct or abuse, people are more seriously looking, journalists are more seriously looking at where they're getting their evidence from. I mean, it couldn't have been sloppier in this case in terms of the journalists taking what they were given. Oh, look, a tiny 1/4 of a page of an affidavit for a search warrant says that Freddie Gray banged his own head to death. Well, we're going to report that. That's terrible journalism. I'm sorry. I'm sure these are good journalists doing that under a lot of pressure. But I would like to see journalists more seriously skeptical about the evidence they're receiving, digging into evidence management, using MPIA requests to not just say, can you give me the files? Because then you're going to get manipulated evidence like the state's attorneys got. But to be specific about their evidence requests. I guess that's my last word.
Amelia?
Yeah. And I would say, like, we really have to look at, you know, to Justine's point, like, when these things happen, the first people who have their hands all over what will become, you know, the evidence in the case are the officers themselves. And, you know, in this case, we see that, for example, with the knife, that knife was, we don't know what it was doing that whole day until it was finally turned in around supposedly 9 o'clock p.m. You know, we don't know where it was. We don't know who was handling it. We don't know for sure which knife was turned in, frankly, I don't think. That's like problematic. And that's the kind of thing that, like, this is all information that that could have been looked into. And it certainly is information that we have publicized over these last 16 episodes. And there have been crickets from the local media. Maybe this is my time to, you know, I find the fact that the Sun, the Baltimore Sun, and the other local media, specifically like the local news and TV stations and stuff, have ignored this podcast. We are talking about, let me say something about the Baltimore Sun for a second, because I have been wanting to say this whole damn season and I haven't. It is fucking appalling to me that they dominated this story for 2 years, every day, as many stories as possible. We have revealed things that have never been disclosed about this case. We have uploaded evidence that has never been seen, okay? They have not reported a drop of it. And yet you have Justin Fenton and Kevin Rector on Twitter, hashtag journalism matters. Get the fuck out of here. I'm sorry. I'm so angry about it because this is doing a disservice to the people of Baltimore. Okay, there is evidence in this case. You don't have to agree with us. Oh my God, I would do anything for them to trash us if it meant that they were actually talking about the stuff we found. Honestly, trash me to hell, drag me. I don't care. Just talk about what we found. Look at it closely. Upload it for other people to see. Tell them about it. You know, this is important. And they are ignoring it. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's just like, hey, this was our story. How dare these women come in and think they can talk about Baltimore and Freddie Gray? They're not from here. This is our story. We've reported everything. I don't know if it's about that. I don't know if it's about them being weird about podcasting and not thinking it's real journalism. I don't know. I don't know if it's because they realize that they missed a lot and they're embarrassed and they don't want to admit it. I don't know what the deal is. But if they're actually looking at themselves in the mirror and thinking that they're right about this, oh no. Oh no. And like, I will not ever let this one go. I think it's appalling. I think it's disgusting, honestly. So that's it.
Word.
Maybe it might be a good thing for me that police officers ignored it, because I still got to be out here. I don't care though. I mean, I don't care. Like, whatever's gonna happen, whatever happens is gonna happen. Like, I've been attacked. You know, I've collected plenty of death threats based on some of the things I've said, but I gotta say it because nobody's saying it. I gotta say it. So, like, I'm at a point now where I can just report. I can report things from around the internet and be safe, but I'm not going to do that because there's certain things, there's certain critiques on how society is hurting people that needs to be said. And I can't see myself not saying it. And I can't see myself not promoting it on multiple platforms.
Well, that's the thing. So that's bravery right there, right? And I think part of the reason why I've had such a hard time with the police officers not speaking up about these kinds of things or not willing to want to participate in this podcast for whatever reason is I think about Harold Perry, who lives in that neighborhood, sees Western District cops coming through, driving down his street constantly. And he comes on our podcast, and as he was telling the media back in April 2015, and he comes on and he shares with us, and he has the bravery to talk to us. This is a 70 plus year old man who actually has, you know, there are actual potential risks to him, okay? And so that's why it's really hard for me to sort of get past, you know, well, I'm worried about what my friends will think.
And it won't be that hard for you. Once we acknowledge that Freddie Gray's life doesn't matter. He's black. He's in Baltimore. He's in a neighborhood that's below the poverty line. That shit don't matter to these people. It doesn't matter. And that's it. You can't, you should be upset. Any person that adheres to any type of fucking moral code would be upset. Some type of moral standard would be upset. These people, it doesn't matter to them. It don't matter. Kill Freddie Gray and then go and then finish your joke. Right. Kill Freddie Gray and then bitch about your overtime. Kill Freddie Gray and then go home to your basic ass family and your stupid ass life. Kill him and keep it moving. It doesn't matter.
There were some emails exchanged with the Castile case where somebody from Ferguson wrote to the Minneapolis or whatever that particular police department was and was like, don't worry, it's going to get better. Like, are you kidding me?
It gets
me?
Better. Yeah. They actually used that phrase. It gets better.
It's going to get better or something like that regarding, you know, we know now this is a hard time for you, the police department. But that it's like, it's fascinating to me that people can be so, I mean, to be honest, I could probably study Nazis and try to get into the mentality. I do find that interesting in the same way that I find the Scientology group mind interesting, where they know that their terror is not as bad what they've done, although they've let some people die also. They're tearing families apart. And it's like to understand that level of fear. I think in a way, I feel afraid myself in life. And I think that there's just, you know, our culture is so fear-based. I mean, corporations are run around fear. Most organizations are based on fear of speaking out. And it's fascinating to me. And it's almost like they don't have therapy cops. They aren't given psychological evaluations. I don't know if they're in touch with that. They just get angry. They got so angry at me. And I don't know if they realize how much fear is underneath all of that, you know?
Yeah.
So, Justine, you did amazing work over the season. It was an honor to work with
you.
It was, you know, just, it was a great pleasure. Looking forward to working with you on other things in the future. Tell our listeners where they can find you. Tell our listeners where they can find you so they can block you.
I feel the same way, D. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's Jewstein. It's Jewstein. I am Jewish. 3000. So Jewstein 3000 on Twitter. And, you know, that's the only one I really use.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Happy to have Marsha and Robbie are joining in the conversation. How you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for having us, Steve.
No, thank you. You did so much amazing work this season. It was so inspiring. Let's go to you, Rabia. You've done so much amazing work over the season. It was a pleasure listening to you and everyone else. So much was learned. It's been a roller coaster of emotions for everybody who tuned in, I'm sure. But what big takeaways do you want our listeners to walk away with?
Well, I mean, first of all, I want to make it clear, because it's always important to give credit where credit is due. The investigative work done this entire season and way before the season started was all Justine and Amelia. They have done incredible work, not just before the podcast began, all throughout to this day. They are literally still investigating. And so for me, and Marsha brought the history, the context, the scholarship, and they are really the ones who have done the work. I was lucky enough to just be looped in so I could kind of just, you know, kind of like help the audience move along from episode to episode, but I was also the audience. I was learning about all these issues at the same time as our audience. Every week when I would like read the script that Amelia and Justine mostly drafted on the investigative issues, you know, I was just blown away by how many devils are in the details, you know, in any given case. And this is something, even though I'm an attorney, and I've said this before, I've never practiced criminal law. I have not had direct interaction with law enforcement, state's attorney's offices. And so I, like many people, have always given them the privilege of just accepting what the official story is. Some things I've learned is that, you know, you have this idea in your head that these institutions are so locked tight. When something's official, it is so official that it just doesn't get messed up. There are times when you have such lapses in documentation and evidence because of really poor work on behalf of the police and state's attorneys. And there's other times when there are clear patterns of misconduct and cover up, and there's no way to look away. And I mean, you know, for the folks who have listened to this last episode, it is so obvious kind of, you know, what happened here. And I continue to be shocked, even though I shouldn't. I should know that this happens over and over again in police institutions, in any institution of power, that, you know, and they say that, you know, the cover-up's worse than the crime. In this case, both things were pretty terrible. But I've learned along with the audience that we have to take with a grain of salt what official statements are. We have to think about who is trying to protect who. And we have to realize that the media doesn't necessarily work as an investigative body anymore. They just don't. They just kind of parrot things. And that is disheartening because not everybody is going to have, for every single story, an Amelia and Justine to do the real investigative work.
Yeah, it's like the media retired, right? It's like they hung their shoes up. So, Marsha, we've all been so honored to work with you and your contributions to the project. And we want you to just give our viewers some of your big takeaways and some of the things that you want them to have.
So at the end of listening to this podcast, I just hope that our listeners really have an appreciation for the bigger story. Not every news story, every incident of police violence will have such devoted resources like a 16-part podcast. But what we do have available to us is so much really solid research online, in print, so many writers, so many activists who've been working on these issues for years. And so if those aren't the people who are being sourced in mainstream media, I really hope that what we did with this story is we really encourage people to go to different sources, go to the sources that are a little bit longer, a little bit more engaged, to get a fuller picture about police violence, about, you know, cities like Baltimore, about civil rights movements, about activists, so that when we see information coming through Twitter or through Facebook, we can be more discerning because we have a more powerful base of knowledge to understand what's true and what's noise.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, I feel like it's like I'm inspired. And then, you know, it's also like it's a difficult situation at the same time because it's, you know, it's, where do we go next or what can we do next or how can we get people to respond to some of the work that has been done?
Well, can I just add to what Marsha just said? And that's this, and she said it, but just being more explicit, whenever these kinds of issues happen, and if you think about what happened with Freddie Gray, and think about how many community members were there to witness it, right? Mm-hmm. And how nobody heard their story and listened to them. I mean, you're going to find this happening again and again. You have citizens who are on the ground who see things. You have community members who know the players. We have to give those voices. We have to give them more credibility than the official statements. Because if they're telling us that that is not what happened, you know, that it's so important for us to, I mean, it's like doing any kind of advocacy work. You go straight to the grassroots, right? They're the people who know exactly really what's going on because they're living those realities day by day.
Yeah. And at what point did it become cool to just not include the community in some of these investigations? Like, when did that happen?
I don't even know. I just think it's bizarre because, I mean, I'm looking through the investigative files that BPD, that we got through the state's attorney's office. And, you know, there are witness notes that the detectives took when they were interviewing witnesses, and they're just sort of like sparse. But there's things there. There's, you know, they're corroborating statements. People are saying similar things. And so to me, I look at that and I'm like, this should have been pursued just as much, if not more, than the statements that were coming from some of the other police officers there. Because, you know, if the excuse is that, oh, there were things and the witnesses were saying that, you know, weren't consistent. Well, there's plenty of inconsistencies across the police officer statements as well. And to me, early on, it was like, it's like they did their due diligence by getting statements, but like really, really paltry statements. And then they were like, okay, we've done that now. Now we're just going to ignore them.
Just to like cover their bases, basically.
Yeah.
Cover their bases,
yeah.
But not actually invest. I mean, my thing is this, what I don't understand is when they say there's inconsistencies, isn't it your job then to investigate those inconsistencies and find out why and like where the truth actually is, instead of just letting them like, you know, sit in a folder somewhere in a statement, like, oh, well, I guess everybody has a different story. I mean, like, that's the whole point of the investigation.
Yeah. Maybe we should acknowledge that these people aren't good investigators. Like, how are they being trained as investigators? Do they read? Are they like, were they good students?
Yeah.
I mean, when they were in school, were they good students? Like, you know, you got a lot of people who decide to be police officers because they don't want to go to college because they don't, you know, they don't really like doing work. Well, this is another job that requires a certain amount of work.
Right. Especially being a detective. Like, I don't know, figuring out. I mean, as somebody who dug around into this case, this was hard. But I look at what they did and I think, oh, if I had been doing this the first couple weeks after this happened, would have been a lot easier. So like they had a much easier job than we did, but they didn't do the work. I mean, that's very clear. And it's shocking. And I think also in this case, you had, you know, a rush to sort of get through this investigation, you know, 2 weeks, like, you know, the police between, you know, Commissioner Batt saying that he was going to have it all done by May 1st. And then Mosby, for whatever reason, deciding to charge that quickly. And, you know, I think everybody was sort of, people were excited about the charges, but 2 weeks.
Well, that's why she charged that. But that's why she did it that quickly, though. I mean, the city was under curfew. You know, businesses were suffering. People were losing money. People were complaining. People who, I mean, I work with media, so I didn't, sometimes I hung out with Boehner and Joe from the city paper, like, oh, nice. It didn't hurt me, but like, when we go outside, nobody else is there. It's like, oh, okay. This is you know, so I think that has something to do with it as well.
I think everything we're talking about also points to the fact is this is what happens when there is no trust. Because if this was a system that people actually believed in or trusted, someone could say, you know what, this is a really complicated case. Can you give us some time? Because if people actually saw that a system was working for them, they can be patient. I think that, you know, in a lot of these stories about, you know, why the investigation was done so poorly, I think that there's a tension between, was it done poorly because people don't know how to do the work, or because they know doing it poorly would serve their interest? And that's where the suspicion comes in, and that's where the impatience sets in, because people have been through this before.
Yeah. I mean, one of my thoughts was with this was that, like, let's say any of these officers had actually been convicted. I look at the investigation and there's so many holes and there's so many things that I could see a defense attorney then being able to go like, well, wait a second here. Like, there, I feel like there's plenty of stuff there for a defense attorney to then use for an appeal, frankly. So it was, it's just so frustrating.
I think those charges were all political, and I think it had to do with just trying to, like, bring some type of light to the city. But, you know, as we learned over the past, 16, 17 weeks of episodes, that those, you know, the real goals, they weren't really met. And as we see now, police officers, you know, are still police officers, like, you know, across the nation. You know, I see them celebrating every time one of their fellow officers murdered someone, killed someone, hurt someone, and they're not being held accountable.
Yeah, I find that upset. Like, I just think that if you're a police officer who's a so-called good police officer, you should, you know, be the loudest to be criticizing those police officers who are sullying what you think policing should be. And more often than not, I would say 99.9% of the time, that's not the case. They're very, very, very quiet. And that's, I'm like, well, if nothing, you're not helping things improve either.
But I also think, you know, like, because of the way these institutions are exist and have always existed. The reason that's really difficult is that I think when people join the force, it does become an us against them mentality. And I feel like there has to be like this top down overhaul. And I know it depends. I mean, like in different jurisdictions, you will have sheriffs who are much more and police chiefs who are much more sophisticated. They understand their communities better. They are highly educated. Or they have a great experience. And so they are better able to set a tone in their departments that, you know, is much more public friendly. But the idea of like, you are in service to the public. We pay your salaries, right? Like you are there to protect
exactly.
us. Right. Like you are our servants. Like, what does it mean to be a public servant? I mean, I think that has to become like revisited and it has to be impressed on folks. And I think that takes like public pressure that you have to go straight to the top and say, show us what your service is to our community. Like, how are you protecting us? But I feel like it's almost, I mean, even as somebody who is not part of the demographic, that's like, if I get pulled over for driving, whatever, if I run a stop sign or something like that, I generally am not in fear of my life. You know, I'm not a black male, but there's still a sense of like an us versus them. Like, you know, I still have a sense that these officers are there to, you know, like there's some adversarial relationship, and that doesn't seem right.
And we see it like, okay, so you see what happened in D.C. over the weekend. Some kids were selling bottles of water, you know, cold waters on a hot day at the National Mall, and they were arrested for that and held, and their parents had to come and get them out. And it's like, if there was some white kids selling lemonade, the cops probably would have bought like a nice frosty glass of lemonade for everyone patrolling the park, and they would have been called young entrepreneurs who are taking control of their own destiny and, you know, and making and doing something positive. So it's like the subtle stuff. So, you know, thank God those kids weren't hurt. Thank God they didn't, you know, they weren't beaten or anything like that. But like, what does that do to your psyche? Like you're not selling drugs. You're not out there trying to, you know, you're not being negative. You're just trying to get to the money, because the unemployment rate for African-American teens in this country is ridiculous. And you might not know these stats, but you're out there trying to do something positive and you're still being punished for that.
Yeah, and that kind of situation has a lasting impact on how you view the police. I can, you know, for the rest of your life. Like you're out there selling water on a broiling hot day and you get handcuffed as a teenager, like that's the kind of thing that would make me terrified of the police and not see them as being there to protect me. And like, if police want the community to trust them and to see them for what they believe themselves to be, then they need to start acting like it.
I also think that there's a larger thing that incident also illustrates. Let's say that, you know, you're not supposed to be selling water without a permit. Who cares? But anyway, let's say you do. And let's say it was another vendor who was upset. There is such a resistance to communicate to young people of color. What if that situation just required a vendor to say, you know, hey guys, I know that this is your hustle. You're really not supposed to be selling in the park. Can we have a conversation? Or do you need a job? Right. So there's these ways that, you know, officers are then deployed as an extension of the inability or the kind of contempt towards kids of color. So it's whether when, you know, kids get the police called on them, or, you know, everything is considered suspicious activity. Those are the ways that I think people passively contribute to this culture of hyper-policing and racism. And then we'll turn around and say, well, yeah, it was unfortunate what happened, but I do wonder if it happened in their own community, if they would do the same things. And so I think that, you know, these types of actions point to a larger comfort in which there's no communication, but the default position is policing, restraint, discipline, and humiliation.
And can I just say this? I mean, let's say they were in violation of like some kind of administrative statute, like, you know, municipal statute, whatever, saying that they needed a permit. We're talking about an administrative violation, not a criminal activity. You understand what I'm saying? Like, this, it doesn't even rise to the level of criminality. I was shocked to see that they were in handcuffs, of all things, right? Like, they were not, like you said, they weren't selling drugs. They weren't armed. There was nothing criminal happening. They were at the most, right, in the police's best case scenario, breaking an administrative statute. I mean, really? In handcuffs? It's unconscionable.
like, what is it? Like a $20 ticket or something? It's like, come on.
It's embarrassing too, though. Like people, grandmothers walking past shaking their head. Like,
it's humiliating.
Yeah. It's like the worst thing in the world to be like, I know from my own experience, like I said, I've been there a bunch of times and just sitting on the curb in cuffs while people walk by, look at you. It's just like, it plays with your psyche. Like it's just not a cool thing. And it hits even harder when you're trying to do something positive.
I mean, I can't imagine that. I mean, I had an experience when I was in something like, I think, sixth grade or something like that. I went to a really weird hippie school where you didn't have to go to class if you didn't want to. And I and some friends were part of like a walk club. I'm telling you, it was a hippie school where we would walk around like the neighborhood for our PE requirement or whatever. And so one day this group of other students and I were out doing our little walk club. And we got picked up by the cops and brought back to the school because the cops didn't believe us when we said that we were allowed to be out and about. But I remember that experience. It's one of those experiences that I'll never forget because I felt humiliated by that. And it wasn't really much of anything. I can't imagine being a teenager and being handcuffed in public by all these other people. I mean, like that would be the complex feelings about, I don't know. It's just awful.
One of the things that I often think about when I now am like kind of making connections between the way the police, our highly, I think now militarized police operate in certain areas and military occupations you see around the world. And even I connect this even to the psyche of young American Muslim males who live in the West is an ongoing humiliation, either by force, by law, through the media, and a kind of almost emasculation that I think like really, especially for young men, like, you know, when you look at like populations that live through like military occupations, whether it's Kashmir or, you know, the occupied territories, there is something very profound that happens to a young man's psyche being humiliated publicly. And I think it does something also to their ideas of what it means to feel like they have some kind of, you know, like what it means to be like masculine, like in a way, not in a toxic way, but, you know, in a way that they actually feel like they have some kind of power. And there's like a sense of like helplessness and despair, I think, that sets in. But I don't know. I mean, I even think that could rise to the level of like PTSD type of stuff. And maybe, Marsha, you know more about that. But it has to have a profound, long-lasting, generational effect on people to feel like they are subject to public humiliation at the whim of anybody who, you know, happens to be policing at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, in some of my research, when I talk to people who came up during the civil rights movement or, you know, people who are activists or people who are just observers, it's interesting. They have a set of practices that are all about evading that type of humiliation. You know, people who don't go to public bathrooms because they were humiliated because they used, you know, a whites-only bathroom when it was colored-only. People who refuse to travel to certain parts of the country, I mean, decades later. You know, all of these practices of self-preservation. It's funny, you know, I started putting my driver's license in the kind of console right next to my car because I remember once I was out with a bunch of girlfriends in grad school and one of my friends was from LA. We got pulled over by the police and she had her ID inside her boot because we were going to a club and we're all dressed up. And I remember her telling the officer, she says, "Officer, I'm going to reach for my ID. It's in my boot. Please understand what I'm doing." And we just kind of got quiet. And she goes, "You guys are from LA." And then all of us are like, "Yeah, we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't keep our IDs deep in our purses." My mom always kept her ID kind of out. And those are the practices, right? You see them as you're young and you adapt them too. And someone has to explain to you why you do it. And it's in things that are big and little. You know, you talk to people of color of a certain age, they have all sorts of survival strategies. And the thing that I think is heartbreaking is that these strategies don't always work.
It was a dude in my neighborhood. I got this from them because I used to do it too. But I got it from an older dude in my neighborhood named Wack, who used to he used to tape his license and his and his registration to the window, so like just to let police know his paperwork was good, because he had like, this was back when Maximas used to be like the big thing. You had like a Maxima and a Pathfinder. Like, they was like the hot cars in the neighborhood, and he got that Maxima and he put them BBS wheels on there, and he used to drive up and down Ashland Avenue, and he got stopped so much that he did that, you know. And it was funny to us, but then when you, like, looking back, and, you know, I remember doing the same thing as, like, you know, because it was funny when I got my first luxury car, you know, coming up, and I got stopped so much, but I knew my paperwork was right. But then when you looking back, you're like, yo, that's, like, sick. It's sick that you even got to play like that. Like, your jokes, it's not even, you shouldn't even have to play like that.
It's insane. I mean, yeah, Philando Castile was going to get his wallet, as he had been instructed to do by the police officer, after telling him, you know, sir, I have a weapon. I'm not going for it. I'm going to go get my wallet. And he got shot 7 times. I mean, it's just like, and I see people, you know, excusing it. Well, the officer told him not to, but I'm like, are you serious? Are you serious?
And the cop, he's such a loser. Like, he looks like such an idiot, like a goofy moron idiot that should never, ever, ever be allowed to touch a gun ever. He's like, he's screaming like, oh, oh, oh. And I'm like, come on, dog. Like, what has happened to you in your life that made you that scared? And then what he says about the marijuana smoke is like, if it would be marijuana smoke in front of a little 5-year-old girl, they would do anything to me. Shut the fuck. You know he said that, right?
Yes.
There is no way that was his thought process at the time. This was like a post-event, like, you know, something he had to come up with. There's no way that was the thought process he was having.
And what a bizarre thing to think. Like, if he would smoke pot in front of his daughter... God.
Unless you're the Attorney General of the United States, because if you are Jeff Sessions, you might think that actually makes sense. But yeah. Otherwise, you know, are you a deeply racist person? You might think that makes sense. Otherwise, if you encounter somebody who is, you think has smoked pot, the most dangerous thing they might do is, like, strip you of your, like, you know, edible goods.
Exactly, exactly.
But also the fact that he was kind of framing it as being protective of this little girl, too, like, in a weird way, like he was looking out for her. I'm like, you pumped her father full of bullets, like... What?
Gotta protect her by killing her father.
Yeah.
Well, the thing that's also interesting, if you read up, there's an article, I think, from February that Radley Balco wrote about how Geronimo Yana's officer participated in some seminar called, like, Warrior Cop or Warrior Officer, where it's like this thing that's this extracurricular that people can participate in to get them really feeling like, militarize their activities, and it's all about, you know, survivalist rhetoric and about how there's all these people with guns ready to kill you. And so there's some real questions. I mean, there's some general questions about his particular fitness, but he also had a history of attending this type of activity that takes a person who already is probably has some hyper assertive issues and making them more assertive. I don't even understand how these seminars are legal or how police officers are allowed to attend these things. But again, it shows that, you know, just having the authority wasn't enough for this particular guy. He's also doing this extra stuff. And I think also if you look at research by the Southern Poverty Law Center, the number of people who join police forces who are members of white supremacist organizations that are also queuing them up in this way. And so you start to see that there are all of these other forces that are animating the decisions of police officers.
You know, the training issue is so important here. I have personal experience with it. But number one, you know, folks have to understand that these trainings are paid for by our tax dollars. Like, you are paying for that kind of stuff. Number two, I know what the vetting process is for these kinds of trainings because I ran a police training firm for about 4 or 5 years. And what it comes down to is I spent a year, like, working with other subject matter experts to put together training materials for law enforcement officers to work with American Muslim communities. But there is no, like... there's no set process and vetting so much that you have to go through versus just having a relationship with, like, the local police chief and going in and just convincing that one person that you should get this training. That's as hard as it is. I was actually surprised. I mean, I had a certain amount of credentials I brought to it because I was an attorney and I had a crew of people who, you know, also were well-credentialed. But I realized at that point the reason some of these horrible trainings happen is because all kinds of people can get their foot in the door. The bar is not that high. And if the police chief or sheriff's department decides that, yeah, I think this sounds good for my officers and, you know, they can get their annual whatever requirements fulfilled by taking one of these classes, that's all it takes. So the training is really dangerous. I mean, you talk about the training you're talking about is so alarming. There was a training in which Homeland Security, and this was reported on and it was an ongoing training, that these trainers made millions where they were training homeland security officials and local police officers, a couple of these trainers who have been named by the Southern Poverty Law Center as people who are like, you know, responsible for like hate speech, and training them, saying basically every Muslim who lives in America is like a sleeper cell agent. Like they're just waiting to act. Like literally that is what they're being trained. And it's amazing the kinds of stuff that can get through.
Yeah. Again, and when you call them racist and when you call their actions racist, you're like some type of conspiracy theorist who is like, you know, and maybe you can speak to this, Marsha, but you know, I call these people racist all the time. And then when I say that, people are like, oh my God, why would you, you're going to use the R word? Like, what is that?
That's one of the most amazing things I've found in my work and traveling all over the country. People can tolerate everything except for the kind of most baseline fundamental foundation of United States history. And so it's kind of like, well, it would be really shocking if you didn't act in these ways, because everything you do is wrapped around some type of racial discourse or racial capitalism. And I think the problem is that we have allowed a series of processes to be considered race neutral. Like where you buy your home and then how much value it's going to have, where you send your kids or don't send your kids, whether there's a bus that comes to your house or a train, or, you know, all of those things are tied up into it. And I think that until we find a way to make it really clear that this isn't about an empty accusation, it's just about a set of realities. I mean, you see how sensitive people get when you suggest that Thomas Jefferson wasn't a hero and that he was a slave owner. These are not shocking revelations, but in, you know, some audiences, even as a historian, if I just simply state that fact, there'll be a million people who will try to explain to me, well, why that doesn't matter. And I said, well, what if we understand that as the thing that matters the most? What would you be able to do differently if you could just accept that reality? So I find it bizarre that, you know, people will have such outrage if you say Jeff Sessions is a racist. It's like, well, that's kind of the nicest thing you can say, considering the incredible power he has to undermine justice issues. So, you know, that's just the starting point. But you're absolutely right. People recoil at that term as if there's any way to be part of the power structure in this country without using racism actively as a tool for your own power.
It's almost like comedy, right? You call a person a racist, right? You call a person a racist, or you call them out on their racism, or you talk about the problems in the system, and then people turn on you. Rabia, are they drinking some type of special Kool-Aid? Or,
you know, I want to give people the benefit of the doubt, because I think unless you have lived experiences, you just don't understand like what another community or another person is kind of going through. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot ever since I've worked in like an advocacy and activism, is how do you convince people of like, you know, if you say that is racist, right? And that for them is fundamental. They just can't accept it. I think that's why stories like this podcast series and other podcasts that are doing the same thing and other kinds of media are important and powerful, because what they do is they present the story, like, here's the facts of what happened, and let people come to that conclusion on their own. Because there are many things you cannot tell people, you have to show people. And so, you know, I know activists who very firmly believe that, you know what, if somebody doesn't understand what I'm saying, if somebody doesn't like validate or value the opinion of people being impacted by whatever racist policies or institutions, then those people are not worth engaging. And I'm not actually one of those people. I don't believe that. I believe that people are not worth engaging only when they get abusive. Up until that point, people are worth engaging because I just think they fundamentally don't understand it. They haven't seen it. And you have to show it to them. So I still think there's hope for those people, as much as you want to shake your heads at them and at how yeah. they don't see it. But our job is to not let them walk away so easily from it.
But they have to be willing to receive the information, right?
They have to be. And so that's my framework for engaging with people. As long as you're willing to keep having the conversation, I'm willing to do it. When you get abusive, I'm going to walk away. But there are so many times when I've called out something and I've had somebody say, well, no, now you're racist for calling that white person racist. I'm like, that's not how it works here.
It's not.
I struggle with that, because to me, I sometimes see arguments where I genuinely wonder whether or not the person has the ability to think with any level of complexity. And that's where I get frustrated, where I'm like, am I going to just, I'm down to have these conversations with people as often as possible for the rest of my life. But sometimes I get frustrated where I'm like, am I exerting too much energy on this one person who just like is incapable and unwilling to think with any sort of level of empathy or depth? That's where I sort of find myself, maybe I should move on to another person.
Well, I'll tell you this. I mean, through now two seasons of Undisclosed, in which we've done Wrongful Conviction, and then one season on Freddie Gray, I have had so many people come and say to me, and I'm talking about white people, come and say to me, I had no idea. I had no idea. I've heard it. I didn't really get it. I didn't believe it. I didn't have any idea how the criminal justice system operates for people of color. It just was like this revelation as they listened to these stories unfold over months and months. And it took that for them to get it. But at least you're right. They were willing to hang in there for all those weeks to listen to it. And in a way, you know, we didn't have to explicitly convince them. They just kind of came to the conclusion themselves. So there might be people that are not worth like your time in terms of cost benefit analysis.
But yeah,
there are, I'm telling you, and you know, the work you and Justine have done is going to change the hearts and minds of many people.
Yeah, we've definitely have had some really amazing reactions from people who I think had not thought about these things before or in this way, and have had them, you know, we met some people like at our live show who came up to, you know, I remember meeting a couple young white women who came up to me and were saying that they've like have been, you know, motivated to like get involved in activism by the podcast and stuff. And that's the kind of thing where you're like, oh man, this is why we do this. Like, that's awesome.
So let's just go around and get if it's anything that we could have done differently, or if there's anything we wish we could have added that got left out. Starting with you, Amelia.
Oh, well, I mean, for me, I feel like we packed in. I knew this case was going to be complicated when I went into it, just by virtue of the fact that there were six defendants and all of that. I did not anticipate just how much of a clusterfuck this case actually was. And so I feel like we've jammed in so much information. Like, I feel like we got to everything that was really, really important for understanding what happened here. Is there other stuff that we didn't get to sort of put on the podcast? Yes. And there are things that I know that I'm still looking into and will continue to look into, and what I end up doing with that material, I don't know. Maybe I'll just tweet about it. But yeah, there are things that I wish we could have gotten into more depth about. But there are things I feel like I didn't want to put on the podcast until I had a better sense of what they actually meant. And so those things I'm going to continue to pursue. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like, now that the podcast is done, I still have a desire to bring as much information about this case as possible public. And we'll do that in kind of any way I can, because I do think that transparency is really, really key here. I think, especially in Baltimore, you know, I think the team that investigated this case investigated other cases, and some of those cases are still pending, Keith Davis. And so for somebody like him, I think putting out this information, there's the potential for this kind of information about the FIT team, about what happened during this investigation, that could actually have an impact on people whose lives are still being kind of hanging in the balance. And so for that reason alone, I'll probably keep, you know, putting information out there and stuff. But this has been a very amazing experience, heartbreaking experience, and I feel incredibly grateful for the opportunity from Undisclosed and everybody involved. I'm like so blessed to have worked with everybody on this team on this project, and I feel very grateful to everybody in Baltimore that I spoke to who was kind and talked to me, and people who didn't talk to me, and everybody. I fell in love with Baltimore doing this project, and I feel very strongly. I feel such emotion towards everybody involved in this case, and I feel very emotional about Freddie, and this was just an incredible experience, and I hope that we were able to make some sort of impact. So yeah,
thank you. Rabia,
actually Amelia answered kind of, I had a question for Amelia at the end of this, and that was that, you know, are you going to be able to walk away from the story? I can't imagine, because you guys have been so sincerely and authentically like engaged in this, and I'm glad, and I hope you don't, because you know, you might still be getting documents that you didn't.
Oh, are you kidding me? I have a long list of ones I'm filing today, MPIA requests. Yeah,
that's great, and I hope we're able to, like, you know, through your social media, your writing, but also hopefully through Undisclosed, we're able to continue to update our listeners on any bits of information we continue to have, because I do believe a big part of justice is truth, and we have to continue to tell the story. And I think the second thing that, I mean, you know, as we know that, you know, the consent decree in Baltimore with DOJ wasn't enforced. And I, we have to keep an eye on how this unfolds because it requires a lot of things. It's going to require better training for the police on de-escalation, on how to interact with young people, mental illness, get better technology. And I have no idea if and how this is going to be implemented, but I think that's an important story to follow as we go forward to see if anything actually changes in Baltimore.
Hey, what do you think, Marcia?
Well, first of all, I think that this has just been such an incredible opportunity for me. You know, as someone who teaches in a classroom setting and travels to different campuses, I'm always concerned about who gets to kind of engage in these conversations or where does this knowledge get disseminated. And as someone from a family of mostly working people, I know that some of the greatest intellectuals have never been on a college campus. And so I think that I just feel so honored to be able to do the thing I love, which is to teach about history, to talk about the history of race in America and Black folks with just a larger audience, and to really show people that, you know, there are many ways where these ideas need to be expressed and shared. And it's not just for books, and it's not just for, you know, college classrooms, it's for everybody. And the more that we democratize the things that we know, the stronger our communities are. And so I'm just always happy to be able to do that, and to do that in a platform so big has been amazing. And I also want to, you know, it's also weird to have listened to Undisclosed and been a super fan and then become part of it. That's like really weird. But I appreciate, you know, Rabia extending the invitation to me and really just trusting me to be able to just kind of respect and appreciate the complexity of Freddie's life and the people who cared about him. But when I'm on the road talking about, you know, social movements and police violence and Black Lives Matter, the thing that I want people to understand is no matter how disposable Black life seems in the larger culture, Black people are loved by many who know them and don't know them. And that the more that we can emphasize that when a life is lost, no matter how the person lived, no matter how they died, it is really a loss, then I think my work has been successful. And so I'm just grateful to have met so many people who are so smart and are so engaged and really have just the bandwidth to go through so many documents. I mean, the investigation that Justine and Amelia were in the middle of was just amazing to watch their brains work and to see the way that, you know, the larger undisclosed universe really uses this platform to tell complex stories about people's lives, I think is just so important. So, you know, for me, this has really changed the way that I look at how to, you know, talk about these issues and where I should be talking about them and the importance of, you know, all formats and doing that. And so I'm just incredibly grateful. And I really hope that we've created something that can live on, that, you know, someone tomorrow will be like, oh, what is this thing? I'm going to start listening, and that it'll continue to be shared, and that people understand at the end of the day that we really, really do want to honor and memorialize people who, you know, our society has thrown away, but were immensely valuable and continue to be valuable because we get to tell their stories.
And I'm thankful for all of you guys, because a lot of these things, like, you know, we feel like we know these things and we feel like we understand how these systems work, but, you know, a lot of times we don't have all of the evidence like available to us. And now we can just say, oh, you want to know how this works? And because of the work that you guys done, we can actually point people into a place where they can get this information for free and understand that we're not all crazy out here. Like we're not crazy.
Thank you for week after week coming and, you know, having these discussions and broadening conversation. Thank you so much for your dedication, for your life's work, and for you are living these realities and for trusting us to tell the story that you have been telling for many years. Thank you so much.
Yeah, seriously, Dee, you were incredible.
The pleasure is mine. Hopefully, you know, it's to be continued under some other capacity, because I feel like the work that we all do is like life's work. It's not like, you know, it's not like a day of service. You know, like it's stuff that we're going to be working on in different ways for the rest of our lives. So hopefully we cross paths again under other capacity. Or maybe have fun. Or maybe we'll try to have fun like one day out of, you know, out of all
this
stuff.
But I think I learned so much from doing this project. I learned so much just from, like, I got excited every week to listen to the addendum, because especially episodes that I wasn't on, because I was like, I wonder what happened on addendum this week. And I learned so much just from listening and from reading my fellow, you know, podcasters' scripts and their work, and I learned so much from Marsha and learned so much from Rabia, and this has just been an incredible experience. I did want to give a quick sort of update on the money that we raised for the Freddie Gray Memorial Garden and for Harold Perry, who lovingly donated the side of his house to that mural. So we raised, I think, about $20,000 for the sixth branch, which is going to be giving the money to Harold Perry and to the Freddie Gray Memorial Garden and mural. And our first big priority, I'm really excited about this part because I've talked with Harold about it so many times. There is a huge dead tree full of apparently like poison ivy behind his house that the city has refused to take down. It's a complicated story why, but it's been a source of real stress for him and his wife, Giselle, because pieces fall down all the time on their house, and they've been very worried about it falling on their house. And if it fell on their house, there would be no mural. So the very, very first thing we're going to do is we're taking down that dead-ass tree. And I know that he feels such just relief over that. So that's great. We're also going to put up a fence to cut down on some of the litter, but you'll still be able to go into the garden and see the mural, obviously. We're going to put up spotlights so that the mural can be seen at night, and then obviously do a lot of sort of gardening and that kind of thing. And once we get to a point where there's actually like a gardening time ready, like once the tree's down and all of that, we might have some sort of like afternoon gardening party or something. So you know, listeners who are in Baltimore and interested in that, keep an eye out on Undisclosed's Twitter account. Probably won't be for another month or two, but we'll keep everybody updated. But Harold and his wife, Giselle, are incredibly moved by everybody's generosity and very excited about the work that's kind of going to be done. And I know for me, one of the relationships I think I will have for a very long time as a result of this project is with Harold, who is just a lovely man and who tells wonderful stories when we talk on the phone. And to me, he's a real hero as far as this case is concerned, especially. So I'm really thankful to all of the listeners who donated money. It's going to a very important cause and a really, really great person. So thank you.
That was great. Rabia, where can we find you at on social media?
You can find me, my Twitter handle is at Rabia Squared, R-A-B-I-A Squared, and I am tweeting day and night.
Okay, great. And Marsha, where can we find you?
Folks can find me on Twitter at Dr. M. Chatlin, that's D-R-M-C-H-A-T-E-L-A-I-N. You can also listen to old episodes of my podcast, The Office Hours of Podcast, to see what it's like when I am one-on-one with my students.
Great, thank you. You know, this is difficult for me to end this. I had a really good time. I got a chance to talk with some brilliant people, people who are so good at what they do, and I've learned so much. I'm a lifelong student, and this really fed me every week. I don't know where I'm going to get like my new sources of information are going to come from, but it's been a very great journey, and I'm honored to be a part of this podcast and a part of this project, and to work with people who love other people. That's what it's all about. And I will hope all our listeners know that, you know, our work doesn't stop with this podcast. It's going to continue in our many different fields. And I thank you guys for coming along with us on this journey, because I know sometimes listening was pretty heavy. You know, we've uncovered some horrific things and showed how the many ways in which our system treats people of color. So I know that was difficult for a lot of people who didn't really understand those realities, but thank you for sticking it out. Thank you for supporting us, and Undisclosed will be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode, which will be just as good. I hope you tune in. Thank you and have a great one.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Ernesto, especially, thank you for being such an amazing partner these past few months. Ernesto stepped up at the last minute to give us a studio for this project, and we're just so thankful that he did. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum. Hannah is the unsung hero of the addendum. She quietly makes it happen every week. She's top quality, super professional, and we're grateful that she's part of the Undisclosed team. Super producer Methil Telhand continues to super produce, and she's my friend. Thanks for being there, Methil. A big thanks to Simply Safe for sponsoring this podcast. Fans, go check out the products. Seriously, we cannot make Undisclosed without sponsorship. We simply can't. It just costs too much. You purchase a sponsor's product using an Undisclosed promo code. Sponsors notice that. Then they give us more sponsorship and we give you more podcasts. That's the cycle. So go buy their stuff and mention Undisclosed when you do. Patrick Cortez, the Webby Award winner, composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson. And maybe I'll see you around sometime. Until then.